Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Welcome to the Reaganism Podcast, where we explore where the Reagan movement lives today. This episode of the podcast is a conversation with Jeff Bezos, the CEO, president, and founder of Amazon Incorporated, and Roger Zakheim, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute. This discussion occurred December 7, 2019, at the Reagan National Defense Forum, the country's biggest national security conference. Jeff and Roger discussed the need for big technology companies to work with the U.S. government, what the national security community can do to recruit and retain technical talent, and ways big organizations like Amazon and the military can remain nimble and innovative. Thanks for listening, and visit ReaganInstitute.org to learn more about the National Defense Forum.
Welcome to the home of Ronald Reagan. Thanks for being here today.
Happy to be here.
Even though it's raining outside, it's morning in America here every day. This is the way we view it. And we're going to just jump right into it. You know, it's written widely that you're a big Star Trek fan, if that's correct.
True. Yeah. I have a minor role in a Star Trek movie.
Which is impressive, but here at the Reagan Library, we care a lot more about Star Wars.
I had to pull a lot of favors to get that done.
Is that okay?
Yes, I understand.
Yeah, I got it. Okay,
Star
good.
Wars,
all right.
Okay.
That's a wonky defense joke, but like 700
I get
people
it.
Got that. Okay. But I was hoping you can connect some dots with me here for a second, because in preparing for this, I read that your grandfather actually worked in the national defense sector. I don't know if folks in the room are aware of this. I wasn't. And that he actually worked in missile defense as well.
Yep.
Give us a little bit of background on that. That was surprising to me.
Well, my grandfather, first of all, was a fascinating man who, with amazing judgment. And I had a very special relationship with him, because I got to spend all of my summers from age 4 to 16 with him on his ranch. He was already retired from government service. And he would take me every summer, because my mom had me when she was only 17 years old. She was still in high school in Albuquerque. And she kind of needed a break from me. And she was incredible. It all worked out really well, thanks to her and my grandfather. But I kind of had, my grandparents also were kind of an extra set of parents for me in some ways. And my relationship with my grandfather was close. He was in government service his entire life. He started out as a messenger. And then, you know, in the Navy on a destroyer during World War II, and then eventually worked for DARPA and also for the Atomic Energy Commission.
I think we have the head of DARPA here as well. He might want to follow up on that.
Yeah, well, and my grandfather would tell me while we were like fixing windmills and castrating cattle and, you know, doing all the things you do on a ranch, he would tell me stories all the time and from his past, and some of them were DARPA stories. My grandfather had amazing stories all the time. And he one day he was at the ranch, and he was going to drive into the ranch. He parked his car at the gate. He was all alone. And the car started rolling toward the gate, and he thought, I have just enough time to throw the gate open. The car is going to roll right through. He almost got the gate unlatched when the car hit the gate, and he caught his thumb between the fence post and the gate, and it stripped all the flesh off the end of his thumb and just kind of dangling there. He was so angry at himself for being so dumb that he took that flesh, ripped it off, and threw it in the brush, drove himself to the emergency room, and they said, hey, that's no problem, we can reattach that. He said, well, unfortunately, I threw it away in the brush. They said, that's okay, we'll go drive back and find it. They all went back, and they looked for it.
He left the hospital and went back?
Yeah, with a couple of people from the emergency room, and they helped him look for it. They never found the piece of thumb. So they, probably something ate it, you know, that's what happens. And so he goes back to the emergency room, and they're like, two options. You can attach, we can graft your thumb onto your stomach and let it regrow for a while. That's the best way, but your thumb will be sewn to your stomach for about 6 weeks, which is not great for a rancher. Or we can take a piece of flesh off of your butt and sew that on. It won't be as good, it won't have the same sensitivity. He said, I'll take the butt graft, that will be fine. And so The funniest part of this story is he, in the mornings, like many of us, he was a creature of great habit. And I remember so clearly watching him eat his breakfast cereal, and he would shave with an electric razor while reading the newspaper. And he would shave for an obsessively long time, like 15 minutes. And shave. And then he would take two quick passes over his thumb because his thumb grew butt hair. So my grandfather was truly a remarkable man.
How do we connect this to missile defense? I'm having difficulty right now.
Well, he was a fan of the Strategic Defense Initiative, and one of the things
visionary then, because right? I mean,
he would have said one of the primary criticisms of SDI at that time was that it was too technically ambitious, that basically just couldn't be done. And my grandfather, about something like that, would have just said, well, then we better get started.
That also sounds like a mantra of your companies.
Oh, there are a lot of things in Amazon and Blue Origin and that are, you know, kind of grafted from my grandfather and his points of view.
That's a metaphor that will never fit the same to me, ever. We're moving on, but we have the leadership and some of those values you learned from your grandfather. One thing I read was that trustworthiness, particularly on the polling of how Americans trust Amazon, so much so that in the poll that I read reportedly has Amazon is more trustworthy than the U.S. military. Really struck me and probably others in the room, because we think of the military as the most trustworthy organization. We just have a Reagan poll out recently, which reaffirmed that once again. How do you build that trust inside your organization and then outside your organization? We're certainly living in a time where there is a trust deficit across many of our institutions. How do you do that?
Yeah, and I know the poll you're referring to, and it was very, we were all thrilled by those results. And there are many different reputation polls that get done, and we're often at or near the top of all of those polls. And I think, you know, I happen to personally disagree. I think the military has earned way more credibility and more trust than Amazon has. I would have voted the other way if I were doing it. But I think the way you earn trust, the way you develop a reputation, is you do hard things well, over and over and over. And the reason the U.S. military in all polls has so much credibility and such a high reputation is because over and over again, decade after decade, the U.S. military has done hard things well. And it really is that simple. It's also that complicated. It's not easy to do hard things well. But that's how you earn trust. And trust, of course, is an overloaded word. It means different things. But what people really are, it's integrity, but it's also competence. It's doing what you said you were going to do.
Delivering. Yeah.
And so, you know, we deliver billions of packages every year, and we say we're going to do that, and then we actually do it. And it's also, you know, taking controversial stance. People like it when you are, you earn trust when you say, no, we're not going to do it that way. I know you want us to do it that way, but we're not going to. And even if they disagree, they might say, you know, I kind of respect that, though. Well, they know who they are.
And it's getting hard in the tech world, certainly. I mean, you see that. You know, I'm in Washington. Not a week goes by with somebody talking about tech, trust, not being there, more transparency. How are you managing that? I mean, is it just that we're going to do what we say we're going
to
do?
Yeah, and it's helpful to have clarity. And so, you know, being clear about here, we are going to do this, we aren't going to do that. And then people can opt in or opt out. They can say, well, if that's Amazon's position or Blue Origin's position or AWS's position on something, then, you know, I don't want to be part of that. And that's okay. It's okay. We live in a big, you know, democracy, it's like lots of opinions, and we want to live in that world. I want to live in a place where people can disagree. What I want, too, is to live in a place where people can disagree and still work together.
Right.
I don't want to lose that.
I want to get back a little bit to the kind of more meta point. Here's where we are. let the chips fall where they fall. But going back in terms of your leadership and how you've built your companies, there's a piece of it that really stands out in terms of what we're working on here at the National Defense Forum. Obviously tech, and we call the dual-use tech world, mm-hmm. is highly relevant to the world of national security now.
For sure.
Workforce is a real challenge. Mm-hmm. We talked about it last night, we'll talk about it throughout the day. You know, you started a bookstore, mm-hmm. yet I've read you recruited top talent without necessarily insane Silicon Valley-sized bonuses or these kind of crazy snack bars or, you know, foosball tables. That's actually maybe a lesson learned for the military, because I don't think they have foosball tables. I know we have General Nakasone here from the NSA. I don't know if he recruits with them, but he certainly can't give Silicon Valley-sized bonuses. So tell us a little bit more about how you recruit that type of talent, and is there any kind of lesson learned for, you know, people in this room, CEOs, general officers,
yeah.
you know, leaders?
No, I think
the
there are some things there. And before I answer that question, I thought you were headed a different direction slightly when you said there, you know, workforce issues, because one of the things that's happening inside technology companies is there are groups of employees who, for example, think that technology companies should not work with the Department of Defense.
We can talk about that. That's good.
Well, that's where I thought you were headed, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's a really important issue. And it's, again, people are entitled to their opinions, but it is the job of a senior leadership team to say no. And that's one of the jobs of a senior leadership team, to say, and my view is, if big tech is going to turn their backs on the Department of Defense, this country's in trouble. That just can't happen. And so we have to, and that it's the senior leadership's team to say to people, look, I understand these are emotional issues. That's okay, and we don't have to agree on everything, but this is how we're gonna do it. We are gonna support the Department of Defense. This country is important.
Are you surprised by its controversial? I mean, that's a controversial thing.
I don't understand the details of it. I do know that people are very emotional, and that I understand. I understand that people have different opinions about things, but, you know, there is truth in the world. We are the good guys. I really believe that. And I know it's complicated, but, you know, do you want a strong national defense or don't you? I think you do. And so we have to support that.
Why don't we drill down that a little bit more, because that strong statement sounds somewhat controversial, right, in terms of where the headlines are framed. But you go back, you know, decades ago, and it was kind of understood. Found this, in 1953, Charles Wilson, who was at the time the former president of General Motors, said during his Senate confirmation to become Secretary of Defense, I guess the report to have said, I thought what was good for our country was good for General Motors and vice versa. Kind of, what's your take on that? Because a lot of people in the tech world would say that's not necessarily the case, or more so that can get me in trouble for making that assumption.
Look, I think we all want to be on the side of civilization. And what kind of, so it's not exclusively only the United States. What kind of civilization do you want? Do you want freedom? Do you want democracy? These are big principles that supersede the other kinds of questions. And so that's where you should go back to. By the way, I didn't answer the question you actually asked.
I noticed.
But
that.
I would.
I noticed.
I think the question was,
foosball tables,
how do you recruit,
big size
how do you
bonuses.
Recruit good, yeah. you know, and by the way, we pay very high and competitive compensation at Amazon, but we have not created that kind of country club culture where you get free massages and you know, whatever the kind of, you know, perks of the moment are. And I have always had a bit of skepticism about those kinds of perks, because I always worry that people will stay part of your company
right.
for the wrong reasons. You want people to stay for the mission. You want them to stay, you don't want mercenaries at your company, you want missionaries. And missionaries care about the mission. It's actually not very complicated, and you can confuse people with free massages. I don't really like the mission here, but I love the free massages. And And so, you know, how do you keep great people, or by the way, how do you keep your great people from leaving? Mm-hmm. So the first thing is give them a great mission, something that has real purpose, something that has meaning. People want meaning in their life. And this is a giant advantage that the U.S. military has, because the people who are in the U.S. military really do have a real mission. They have meaning. And that is huge. And so that's a big recruiting advantage. But you can drive great people away. You can drive them away by, for example, making the speed of decision making really slow. Why would a great person stay in an organization where they can't get things done? They look around after a while and they're like, look, I love the mission, but I can't get my job done because our speed of decision making is too slow. And this happened, you know, so large companies like Amazon need to worry about that too, just as the Department of Defense.
Over 600,000?
Yeah, we have 600,000 plus people. That's
I heard the chief of staff of the Army is a little jealous of your end strength, by the way. That's the rumor going around.
By the way, we do have a whole program called Amazon Warriors, which we've been extremely successful recruiting veterans and veteran spouses. And we call them Amazon Warriors. And we are well defended at Amazon. But it is, and there are ways to increase the speed of decision making. And it's super important. And if I was going to be so bold as to advise the senior leaders in this room, I would say one of the things to watch out for is that, and I see it at Amazon, that junior executives model senior executives in their decision making. And that's normal. But you're always kind of looking up at the senior people and you're kind of modeling. A lot of it is even subconscious. But the problem is there are two types of decisions. There are decisions that are irreversible and highly consequential. Highly consequential, irreversible decisions, we call them one-way doors. They need to be made slowly and carefully. I find myself often at Amazon, I'm the chief slowdown officer. I'm like, whoa, I want to see that analyzed 17 more ways. And that's right, because it's a highly consequential, irreversible decision. The problem is, most decisions aren't like that. Most decisions are two-way doors. You can make the decision, and you step through, turns out it was the wrong decision, you back up, you can do it again. And what happens in large organizations, it doesn't happen to startup companies, but in large organizations, all decisions end up using the heavyweight process that is really intended to be used only for irreversible, highly consequential decisions. And that's a disaster. So you need to be constantly, when there's a decision that needs to be made, you need to ask people, is it a one-way door or a two-way door? If it's a two-way door, make the decision with a small team or even a high judgment individual. Make the decision. If it's wrong, it's wrong. We'll change it. And likewise, if it's a one-way door, let's analyze it 5 different ways. Let's be careful, because that is where slow is smooth and smooth is fast. You do not want to make one-way door decisions quickly. You want to get consensus or at least drive a lot of thought and debate.
Is a measure of leadership knowing whether you're at a one-way door or a two-way door?
Yes, and that takes judgment too. But what I find is that people don't even ask that question. They just default to the heavyweight decision-making process. Again, this only happens in large organizations. The other thing that can really speed up decision-making is teaching the principle of disagree and commit. So you've got passionate missionaries, which you have to have. Everybody cares. And if you're not careful, the decision can be made with a process that is basically, you know, a war of attrition. It's just whoever has the most stamina is going to win the decision. And eventually, the other party the party that has the opposite opinion or the other opinion will just capitulate. Like, I'm exhausted. We'll do it your way. That is the worst decision-making process in the world. It leaves everybody demoralized, and you also got a kind of random result. A much better approach is for the more senior person to either, to when this comes, we have to escalate. Controversial decisions need to be escalated quickly. You can't let two junior people argue for a year and exhaust themselves. You have to teach those junior people, you have to escalate. When you're really at loggerheads, escalate and escalate fast. And then you, as the more senior person, you hear those points of view and you say, look, none of us knows what the right decision is here, but I want you to gamble with me. I want you to disagree and commit. We're gonna do it this way. But I really want you to disagree and commit. And here's the important part. Sometimes this disagreement happens between the more senior person and a subordinate person. The subordinate really wants to do it one way and the senior person really thinks it should be done a different way. And it's often the case that it's the more senior person who should disagree and commit. I disagree and commit all the time. I'll debate something for an hour or a day or a week, and I'll say, you know what? I really disagree with this, but you have more ground truth than I do. We're going to do it your way, and I promise I will never tell you I told you so.
How's that working out for you?
Works out great.
I think.
It's very calming, really, because it's acknowledging a reality that the senior person, you're hopefully a senior person because you have a lot of experience, and therefore you have a lot of judgment. And the judgment is super valuable, and that's why sometimes you should overrule your subordinate even when they have better ground truth. So sometimes, but that's your judgment. And sometimes you're like, you know, I know this person or I've worked with them for years. They have great judgment. They really disagree with me. And they have way better ground truth. I'm going to disagree and commit.
I see some senior executive of your team with big smiles right now. They're over here.
They've all seen it. They've all seen it go both ways. I have asked them, no, please do this my way. And they've all seen me say, oh, I really don't agree with this, but I'm on your team.
Definitely.
Go do it.
Lessons there for what we call affectionately bureaucracy in the Pentagon, for
sure. Speed of movement is so important.
So I want to move topics, but build on that word speed. We're hearing that a lot last night, and we'll hear it a lot today. Speed in decision making, speed to keep up with those our country are competing with. The language of great power competition abounds, and the leadership in this room deserves a lot of credit because, as you know, it's fairly recent since we've been focusing on this great power competition. I was excited about this opportunity to chat with you because, not being an expert in technology, but just like everybody else seeing your companies and their performance, they're known as disruptors that come in and win the competition.
Yeah.
But then I've read some of the other stuff you've spoken about, particularly in business, and it's not always a win-lose proposition, is what I've read you say, particularly for sectors.
Not a zero-sum game. Often it's not.
So talk about competition.
In an armed conflict, it kind of is. So,
no doubt.
There are things that are zero-sum games. Sporting events are zero-sum games. Elections are zero-sum games. One candidate's going to win, one candidate's going to lose. Two teams enter an arena. One's going to win, one's going to lose.
Sports, yeah.
Most business things, industries rise and fall. So, several competitors can do well. That's very normal. The thing about the most important thing for doing well against competition, I think, and it certainly applies in business, but I think it would apply, with military adversaries as well, is you need to be both robust and nimble, and it is scale. So it's great to be the U.S. military because you're big. Scale is a gigantic advantage, because it gives you robustness. You can take a punch. But it's also good if you can dodge a punch.
Right.
And that's the nimbleness. And as you get bigger, your robustness gets better. You can take a lot of punches to the head. But your nimbleness gets worse if you're not careful.
So how are you staying nimble in your companies? Because you're bigger than the Army right
now,
for example.
It is just a few things, but it's in the way you have to do it is, first, it's the most important one is what I was just talking about, which is decision-making speed. Decision-making speed is the most important piece of nimbleness. And you guys could see it in everything you do is, whether it's developing new technologies or procurements or organizational structures, but also the tiny little decisions that build up, that really make everything work or not work. So then the second piece is you have to be willing to be experimental. So, you know, you have to be willing to take risks. You have to be willing to fail. And people don't like failure. And by the way, it's, I always point out there are two different kinds of failure. There's experimental failure. That's the kind of failure you should be happy with. And then there's operational failure. When we build, you know, we've built hundreds of fulfillment centers at Amazon over the years, and we know how to do that. If we build a new fulfillment center and it's a disaster, that's just bad execution. That's not good failure. But when we are developing a new product or service or experimenting in some way and it doesn't work, that's okay. That's great failure. And you need to be, you need to distinguish between those two types of failure and really be seeking invention and innovation.
So I want to hit on that because, you know, stepping back, talking about the competition,
yeah,
speed, bureaucracy, really good points in there. But the other thing that we need to do, and I think there's an, you know, analogous in the business world, is what you just said, to innovate, to not simply do things the way we've done it. I think everybody in this room would agree that the challenge is to take these, make sure these big organizations don't calcify.
Yeah.
Right? That you're doing things in a fresh way. How do you sustain that in an organization that
you need the right people, you need innovative people. Innovative people will flee your organization if they can't make decisions and if they can't take risks. So that is, you know, you might recruit them initially, but they won't stay long if they can't do, you know, builders like to build. It's not, a lot of this stuff is very simple, really. It's just hard to do. But you, and the other thing about, you know, competition, and this is why you need innovation, and especially, you know, in some of our domains like space and so on, and cyber, and because you don't want, when life and death, as it is in the military, is one of the metrics where you're literally talking about stakes that are life and death. You do not want to play on a level playing field.
Right.
That's for Monday Night Football. It's great. It's not for, you know, armed conflict. That's and we have for decades enjoyed an unlevel playing field in places like space, where this country has, you know, and in technology in general. And I'm very nervous that is changing rapidly. And the only way to stay ahead and to keep that unlevel playing field, which is what you certainly want, is to innovate.
So,
you know, and we can talk about it in the space domain.
I would love to, because I mean, you use that word. I think I heard you say nervous about the ability to innovate. And I think there's probably a shared angst
facing,
here.
You're facing adversaries who are good at innovating.
So that's
the real issue is if you're facing adversaries who are not good at innovating, and you don't have to be that good at innovating. But if you're facing adversaries who are good at innovating, you better
be good at innovating. It matters more. I mean, we did a poll, this I was referencing before, on innovation in space, in AI, and in cyber, polling American people on this. And everybody agreed that the U.S. is one of the best, but there was a minority who believed the U.S. was the best. And what I hear you saying is when it comes to competition, being one of the best is not good enough. And that's
you
the
don't
risk
want No, I mean, yeah, you do you really want to plan for a future where you might have to fight a fight with somebody who is just as good as you are? I wouldn't.
You don't want a fair fight. General Mattis is here someplace.
No.
He would say that a lot. He's not into fair fights.
No, not. I mean, again, this is not a sporting competition. You don't want to fight fair. Do you guys want to fight fair? I don't think so.
I have 3 seconds left, and I was supposed to ask you about space colonization, but my sense is that's probably not a good idea. So everybody, please join me in thanking Jeff Bezos for joining us here at the Reagan National Defense Forum.